There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1090, April 14th, 2025. Stephen.
This F1 Weekly Podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads provide you, the F1Weekly.com web surfer, with ads that interest you. From tickets to the Canadian Grand Prix to ringtones for your cell phone, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Stephen, and thank you, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, Oscar Piastri wins his 50th Grand Prix with authority. Russell hangs on despite electronic gremlins galore. Norris finally passes Leclerc for third. And Max goes from ecstasy to agony in 1 week. And on today's show, we start with Jason Bentley, the original JB's reportage on the Chinese and Japanese Grand Prix, with thoughts on the loss of Nasser. And of course, more classic Nasser Hamid this week with another stylish, top of the mark interview. And it's Tony Brooks from May of 2009. And yes, indeed, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you'll want to.
G'day, it's Jason Bentley, the original JB from Australia, dialing in from downtown Suzuka. I'm here with other F1 familiar fellow Aussies, Dave and Katrina from the West Coast and Ranjan all the way from the US West Coast. We met up in Australia last year at the Australian Grand Prix with Nasir. I took Nasir on an Australian motorsports tour before that GP, and it was a real treat to share a little bit of my knowledge and learn a lot more knowledge from Nas. During that time, we all talked about future Grand Prix that remained on the bucket list, and over the months, plans were made for Nasir and I to go to this year's Chinese Grand Prix and the Japanese Grand Prix. The Australian Grand Prix had sold out in minutes, so we weren't able to get seats for that. Otherwise, we may have done the first three rounds together. Ranjan, Dave and Katrina were going to meet us in Japan. As it worked out, Ranjan managed to get a ticket for Australia, so he came from San Diego to Melbourne, got thoroughly soaked and went back home to dry up until Suzuka. Due to our loss of Nasir, I went alone to China. Shanghai was the track where Lewis could have been in the box seat to become a rookie world champion. I had a Lewis 44 Ferrari cap on the seat next to me that was booked for Nasir. So how perfect it was that Lewis won that sprint race in a Ferrari. Nasser would have been very, very satisfied. For me, I was excited to see my Aussie mate win on Sunday. For those who haven't been to Shanghai and are curious, the grandstands on the corner at Shanghai have excellent views. I was down at the 1-2-3 complex, and it was a great direct view of those corners, plus some distant views across the back of the circuit. Getting around the venue, that's easy and compact. There's a train station at the main entrance of the circuit, and it's all operated with the mass Chinese population efficiency that you can imagine. A few stops along the train line, there's a Shanghai Motor Museum. It's small, but it's well put together with cars from across the globe and across the decades. It was definitely worthwhile doing, but I absolutely missed having my private tour guide with me, who would have had a story about each and every car. Moving on to Suzuka, I can assure you it's everything you imagined and more. Dave, Katrina and Ranjan met me in Suzuka, and the location, the views, the icons of the track, the memories, the facilities, they're all perfect. There's no bad grandstands at Suzuka, they've all got amazing views, and the GA viewing is better than many grandstands on street circuits. Your ticket includes free entry on that Ferris wheel, yes, that Ferris wheel that you see, free rides on that, and entry to a small Honda racing museum. This year, the museum had the first Honda to win at GP, which was Richie Ginther's 1965 Mexico car. There were some Ayrton Senna McLarens, and even Nando's 2015 McLaren. It was hilarious watching the Japanese fans walk past Nando's McLaren, speaking in Japanese, and interrupting their Japanese with, GP2 engine, ah! And then they start giggling. So, good on them for their humour. The fans are passionate, but unsurpassed for their politeness and kindness. The race was a procession, but for Nasir, every fun race was a beautiful race. We missed having him with us at Suzuka. He would have loved to have seen a car that had no right to be on the podium, being on pole, and taking the win in the slower car. I saw some footage of Fernando being interviewed after quali, and he looked up at the screen and laughed, and the journo asked him why he's laughing, and Nando said, only Max can do that. When one legend recognises the unique talent of another driver, that driver has to be special. So I'm glad I got to see a part of history. Four on the trot at Suzuka for Max. That's something special, something that will be spoken about. And there's not many winners at Suzuka over the years who haven't been world champions. So all in all, great two races for me. Great to have familiar with me in Japan. And let's see what the future brings. I saw a quote recently, and it said that when an old man dies, the world loses a library. And see, he wasn't an old man, but his knowledge was beyond the contents of a library. His modesty, his generosity, his kindness, fairness to all, and genuine warmth of friendship is too big a loss for words. Thank you, Nasir, for sharing your passion to motivate and grow our love of this wonderful sport. And Clark, keep up the good work. We appreciate what you're doing to keep Nasir in our minds while you're managing your own deep sadness. Racing regards, six more sleeps until Bahrain.
JB, thank you very much for that touching tribute. So there it is, Piastri slowly but surely becoming more comfortable at McLaren. Norris having been there longer than him. It's taken him a little bit of time, but now he's making less mistakes in qualifying, in the race, managing tires. He has become the ideal driver with no BS ever, which is unfortunate. I like a little color, but it was fascinating to see. And I think he will continue to begin surging towards the championship. Norris, once again, super nice guy, but he does have a little anxiety sometimes that makes him make small mistakes. And of course, with these Pirellis, those mistakes are exacerbated in the race. But nevertheless, it was fun to watch him just take off and control the entire race. And Norris's start from 6th to 3rd was phenomenal. He was on the softs, had the grip. And, I mean, I have to admit, the decision for Ferrari to go to the hards later on in the race was mind-boggling. I don't know what happened to Red Bull, but I mean, obviously they forgot to drink the Red Bull, or maybe I suspect that they got some free pasta from Barilla, went over to Ferrari for a nice jar of marinara sauce, and boom, chaos begins. And of course, Pirellis and Red Bull just don't mix. And Pierre Gasly really in the Renault. Let's face it, this is the last year for Renault before they switch to Mercedes for 2026. And Pierre Gasly and even Doohan was doing a good job for sure for their last season. My hats off to Pierre. And Haas, Ocon, really fairly impressive in the race. And I was really impressed with Yuki finally getting into Q3. That monkey is off his back, even though the car is brutal. But some of his, I hate to say this, but some of his kamikaze moves were certainly entertaining, but not so much for Carlos Sainz Jr. So very, very fun weekend. It was a little windy, but George Russell and the Gremlins, I'm not sure, I don't think I've ever seen a car have so many issues. And when they told him that his steering wheel could go dark, just ignore it and continue. And I have to admit, George Russell has become the nicest guy with a lot of machismo and good looks. This guy's got everything. So, I mean, Toto's got to be over the moon, especially with his new apprentice, Antonelli, that they're loving and nursing along and being praised on how they're handling their rookie compared to the boys over at Red Bull and how they handle their revolving door. No, very, very, very good stuff. Antonelli was very impressive in this entire Grand Prix. He is showing what he needs to show. Liam Lawson, listen, folks. Once again, I know he wanted to be in Formula One, but this guy is not going to be around much longer. He might finish the season, certainly, but I hope he gets a degree in economics or something, because the other big problem, and I'm sure Audi must have vomited for a few days with the Trump tariffs. I mean, Volkswagen is already having economic problems to boot, but with the tariffs coming in, because Volkswagen depends on the United States for their bottom line, they sell a lot of cars in America, and the tariffs have, I just don't see how these people are going to be able to afford to be competitive in 2026. And let's not forget, we had the big meeting of all the important people in Formula One that make the big decisions. And this was so predictable that really, I wish we had some parlay betting on this decision. But yeah, V10s out the door. It's just not economically feasible, especially today in this, how do you call this atmosphere? Disastrous, scary, bizarre, but it is what it is. So it's going to be tough for Audi. And then, you know, it's not talked about too much, but Red Bull going to Ford, you know, it doesn't even roll off the tongue easily, much less trying to visualize the old days with the DFV. So 2026 could be a brutal season. And this is where, once again, Fernando. Really, I really wished he had retired, I don't know, after the GP2 engine, before the GP2 engine. But this is really hard to watch. I mean, Aston Martin, and we're talking billions here. It's starting to really look a lot like Toyota. And I know they have a new wind tunnel. I know they're throwing a lot of money at this. But I don't see how Adrian Newey can come up with a dominant vehicle with a Honda package that's, I mean, it's quick. It does pretty good with the Racing Bulls and with Max. But I think Honda certainly if they don't come out dominating in 2026, I just don't see how they survive. And you know what happens at Honda. They'll pull out again. So there's a lot of strangeness in the world, but really the Mercedes package is the fastest, I think. Obviously, McLaren has a great aero package and good suspension tweaks and setup. But look at George and what he does. And Kimi, what they're doing with that package. I think they're going to be up there fighting very, very soon for wins. Now, fourth and fifth for Ferrari was, I think, the top of the top. I mean, they still have a lot of issues. And I think Lewis is beginning to come to grips with the car. And I think, you know, eventually he might out-qualify Leclerc here and there. But Ferrari really, it's still a big, big question mark. Especially when you see Gasly doing this up to P5, P4 in qualifying with a Renault. So Gasly is really driving maybe above and beyond his capabilities. So, interesting. Hülkenberg, I feel bad for him once again in a crappy car. And next year, you know, I don't care how German he is and how German Audi is. I think we're going to see ugliness next year. I don't see this new motor performing better than what we have today. And I think there's going to be a lot of disappointed people. I think Mercedes, once again, as the beginning of 2014 and how they've dominated the hybrid era, will do so again. It'll be a miracle if Ford could get anything done. So next year is going to be a tough year. And the other problem is, you know, they keep talking about Max going to Mercedes. That's not going to happen. George is definitely, he's in, so is Kimi, for many, many moons. I think Red Bull and Max are stuck together until 2028 because I think Max knows that the Honda engine will be improved and different in 2026, but I just don't see Aston Martin being competitive or getting rid of Lance. There's no reason to get rid of Lance because really everything lands on the back of the car. So I am absolutely at a loss at why Fernando would want to come back in 2026, even though I know contractually he is. But I'd love to see Fernando retire, step aside, just say, you know what, my bones hurt. Then there's the door open for Max because simply for the large paycheck. He has a family to feed now. You know, the child will be coming soon from Kelly, PK, and him. And that's going to be a loving, loving thing to watch. So there you have it. We have an interesting race in Jeddah. I mean, I have never seen Red Bull fumble it when they used to be the fastest pit stops and they had horrendous pit stops. How could that system, which should be really foolproof, if I understand it correctly, not work at all? And then to not get a lollipop from the museum across the street and start using that, it would have been faster. They would have saved a second or two for sure on those pit stops. So I don't know. The mood at Red Bull is not going to be good. They could be in big trouble at Jeddah because I think, let's face it, McLaren are the dominant factor. If Norris did not make the mistake in qualifying, he would have been on the front row ahead of George, even though George is very, very quick. So Jeddah will be different for Ferrari. I think they will look good. I think Leclerc will shine. But we have, what we have here is, I think, full-blown McLaren domination. It just doesn't seem to be that way right now because I think Mercedes is going to be competitive, but they still have a rookie, even though I think he's doing well. So the fun for me was watching Yuki Tsunoda, because really, Yuki was up against the wall like a redneck mother. I mean, he had no choice but to battle for every little inch, even if it meant hitting cars, causing chaos. He had to do it, and he did it. He did it. And Max Verstappen, I mean, God, those pit stops. I can't even, there's no way they played all those radio calls, because Max must have been fuming at those pit stops. It's fun. What's cool about Max is he's much calmer now and actually is not blathering. We haven't heard him cuss. And of course, with the FIA, the other funny thing was Mohamed Sulayem being snubbed by Lewis Hamilton. I enjoyed that wonderfully, because, you know, Lewis is tired of playing the political correctness game. All in all, fantastic. I'm looking forward to Jeddah, because it's such a fast race. It's such a crazy track. And let's see if Oscar can continue, because now Mark Webber must be thrilled to death. I think Oscar taking the lead in the world championship after Jeddah would be awesome for the Australians, for JB, and the rest of the world, and for McLaren. I'm not a McLaren fan, but you have to admit, they are doing a fantastic job with that Mercedes power plant. Yep, it's going to be tough. Now, everybody, I want you to enjoy this fantastic, classic Nasser Hamid moment with Tony Brooks, just the way he sets it up. Of course, he was thanking Peter Brazier for the official F1 Weekly limousine services. But yeah, great interview. Nasser is the king at this. And once again, Nasser, I miss you very much. Enjoy.
Thank you, sir. Tony Brooks, one of the legends of motor racing from the early part of the World Championship. Tony Brooks was a medical student when his passion for motor racing extracted him from being a dental surgeon. In fact, he carried his medical books to Syracuse, where he won the non-championship Syracuse Grand Prix. This made him the first British driver to win in a British car on the continent since Sir Henry Seagrave's victory in the San Sebastian Grand Prix of 1924. So there's a lot of history here. In 1958, he won the Belgian, German, and Italian Grand Prix, and these were all at classic tracks, you know, Spa, Nürburgring, the 14-mile, and Monza without the, you know, the chicanes. And he was third in the World Championship. In 1959, he finished second in the championship. My sincere thanks to Mr. Tony Brooks for his time, Mrs. Brooks for hot tea, and Mr. Brazier for timely transportation. Without his help, you know, this would not have been possible. I also would like to thank Mr. Stuart Pringle of BRDC, who was kind enough to forward my request for interview to Mr. Brooks. So it was quite a global effort to make this.
Very team-oriented effort there to get that interview.
Yeah, I'm very thankful to all the people here, and I hope our listeners enjoy this conversation with Tony Brooks.
Okay, I'm here in England with Tony Brooks, a British racing driver, British racing legend from the first decade of Grand Prix Formula One racing. Mr. Brooks, first of all, thank you so much. How are you today?
Well, thank you for the invitation to participate.
Before we talk about your great career, can we please get your thoughts on Britain's latest world champion, Lewis Hamilton, and the manner in which the 2008 championship was achieved on the last lap?
Well, he's obviously an outstanding driver, and you know, he was lucky to win his championship, and one can sympathise with Massa, who of course thought he'd won the championship, and I think the way he dealt with the post-race interviews was absolutely outstanding. He would really behave like a gentleman and a champion in prospect. Lewis Hamilton is absolutely outstanding, but it was a lucky win, and had it started to rain 2 minutes later, Massa would have won. And I think one has to bear in mind that Massa, in fact, was robbed of two races in the Hungarian Grand Prix. He was three laps from the finish when his car packed up. And then, of course, Ferrari messed up his pit stop in Singapore. So I've got a lot of empathy for Massa, not least because I finished second in the World Drivers' Championship in a Ferrari, so perhaps I'm a little bit lacking in objectivity there. But Hamilton is, you know, an outstanding driver, no question about it, and he was in arguably the best car of the year. But he made the most of it, but he also made quite a few mistakes, so he's going to have to cut down on those if he wants to be a consistent world champion.
Sounds like you follow Formula One regularly these days. Do you, if the race is out of Europe at an odd hour, would you get up to watch it live, or how do you follow these days?
Yes, I won't get up in the middle of the night to watch it, but I'll certainly watch it recorded on 3 o'clock, and if you don't hear the news, it doesn't make any difference, really. If you don't hear the news before the race is broadcast the second time. So, yes, I follow it fairly closely. An armchair observer, and occasionally go to Monaco, but I don't attend the Grand Prix normally.
In 1955, you took a historic win at Syracuse, first British win on the continent in over three decades. Please tell us how this deal with Connaught came about.
Well, I was invited by Connaught to go and drive the car in Syracuse, and I hadn't actually ever sat in a Formula One car until the day before the race, which was the Saturday, the race being on the Sunday, the 23rd of October, I think it was. I was invited there because I'd done one or two races in an old Formula Two Connaught, and obviously Connaught thought that I was a reasonably safe pair of hands, and gave me a chance. But I mean, in those days, October was after the end of the season, and I think there was a great shortage of suitable drivers, and I think in desperation, frankly, they chose me because I didn't really have I hadn't even sat in a Formula One car, so I was very lucky that they had faith in me to give me that opportunity.
I read when you got there, they requested do not put on a lot of miles on the car because they were more concerned about the prize money, and you only did like 12, 13 laps before the race began?
Yes, that's right. Well, they had trouble getting the cars there in time because they had, first of all, trouble with their documents when they got to Calais, or was it Dunkirk? They also had problem in those days. The motorways the autoroutes didn't go down the length of Italy, so they were in converted green line buses, and they had quite a difficulty going over the mountain passes and so on, which they had to do in those days, reversing backwards and forwards to get round the corners and that sort of thing. So they arrived late on the Saturday. Obviously, they should have been there on the Thursday at the latest. So when they got there, of course, the important thing was to have the car start, because the Connaughts were desperately short of money at the time, and it was the starting money which had attracted them to go to Syracuse. And literally, if you didn't start, you didn't get starting money. So the car didn't have a great reliability record, so that they didn't want me to do many laps in practice for fear of having him problems and not collecting their starting money.
And you rewarded them by winning the race at age 23. What is interesting, and I've read this many, many years ago and recently also, of course, that when you were flying to the race and coming back, you had your medical books getting ready for the exams. What was that like, and what was your plan at that time? Did you want to be a dental surgeon like your dad, or were you more interested in being a racing driver?
No, I qualified, because obviously racing driver, particularly in those days, was not a very long career. I mean, in the 50s, there were an average of 3 to 4 drivers killed a year every year. So it wasn't really a long-term business, really. I think Stirling saw it that way, but it was the record, the track record was poor. So I always intended to finish my dental degree, which I did in December 56. But I was studying for my exams on the way out on the plane, on the way back on the plane, which is just as well, because it prevented me thinking too much about what I'd said I'd go and do.
Yeah. And talking of traveling, nowadays everything is done by a travel agent or PR people. How would drivers make arrangements to go to continental Europe, Morocco, South America?
Well, I think the team would make those arrangements normally, and depending on your arrangements, if that is if they were paying for your travel expenses, and they would arrange the trip for you. But maybe you have a deal whereby, you know, you pay for all expenses, hotels and everything, which goes to be down to you to make the arrangement.
You already addressed my next question, dangers in motor racing. Was there any... how did your family look at it, especially parents? Were they concerned about you trying to become a racing driver, or did they encourage you?
No, my parents were very enthusiastic, and they very much encouraged me. And my mother was very disappointed when I decided to give up racing, but I think really a question of ignorance being bliss, and that I think she thought I was infallible. Unfortunately, I wasn't, and nor was any other racing driver.
You were in the tragic 1955 Le Mans race. How do you remember that day, especially after what happened there with Pierre Levet?
Well, it was a very sad day indeed, to state the obvious, and of course it did bring motor racing to almost a halt in 55, because all the governments reacted very badly to that, because there were 80 plus spectators killed in that accident, and so motor racing got a very bad press, and a lot of people took fright. And in fact, the Swiss never ever held another motor race after that incident at Le Mans. So it was, a very sad day for most of all the driver and the spectators involved, but also for motor racing, because it gave it a very bad image, very bad record, and resulted in a lot of races being cancelled.
Your Formula One debut in 1956 at Silverstone was not very kind to you. What went through your mind when you realized the throttle was stuck at Abbey?
That wasn't my debut. My debut was, of course, Syracuse, although that wasn't a world championship event.
That's what I mean.
But my first world championship Grand Prix was at Silverstone, and the car was very quick in a straight line, but unfortunately it didn't handle. And if you went round a corner, other than geometrically, it didn't like it. And if anything untoward happened, it really, you know, you couldn't do anything about it. And accelerator stuck going into Abbey, having been repaired in the pits, because it broke. I mended it temporarily, got into the pits, lost about 7 laps whilst they were trying to fix it. And I'd been taking Abbey curve flat, and whilst I'd been in the pits, obviously a little bit more oil and rubber had been put down. So when I went back on the circuit, I just needed a quick lift as opposed to going flat. And when I lifted my foot off the accelerator, it didn't respond, and the throttle was stuck open. And with a normal car, it would be impossible to run along the grass for perhaps, you know, 50 yards or so and edge back onto the circuit. But once you touch the grass with that car, you know, that was completely out of your control. It would spin out of control and, bounced across the circuit to the outside again, and turned itself over and did the only decent thing and set itself on fire, because it was that sort of motor car, it needed to set itself on fire. But I was very lucky to get away with just a broken jaw and a chipped ankle bone.
In 1957, you made history again with Stirling Moss at Aintree, first all Britishman in a Formula One race. In those days, you know, drivers could be called to give up. In this case, his car broke down. But how did you feel about being teammate to Moss? And I understand the team was leaning more towards him than you.
Well, it wasn't. It was prearranged that he should take over my car, because I'd had an accident, my only other serious accident in my career, which was at Le Mans, and I'd been under an Aston Martin at Le Mans about 4 weeks or so beforehand, and I had tremendous abrasions and so on, and you could put a tennis ball into the hole that was in my hip. So I shouldn't have been allowed to race, but obviously you've got more chance of winning if you have 3 Van Wall start rather than 2. So I agreed to start, and in fact I made second fastest time in practice to Moss, I think a couple of tenths of a second slower. But doing one fast practice lap and doing 90 laps in the condition I was, you know, it just wasn't on. I mean, I couldn't have maintained. I shouldn't have been racing. And so it was arranged that if Stirling had some trouble with his car, I would bring my car in and he would take over. But he would never, ever take over my car in you know, in normal circumstances. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. You've just got to look at our respective times.
Yeah. But did you feel that the team was more interested in seeing Sterling Moss win? I've heard reports or read interviews, you know, your interview, that you felt that you were not treated equally at Van Wall.
Yes, of course. Well, he was number one driver, and I signed on to number two, and I didn't like it. I shouldn't have signed the contract. So, yes, he had priority. He had, you know, he had the choice of engine, choice of chassis, and so on, you know, and he ensured that he had the best car as number one driver, which obviously is to my disadvantage. But I was in a very competitive team with virtually no track record, so I was counting myself lucky to be in the team. It was up to me to earn my stripes, as you might say, and you know, get equal rating, which of course I did when I went to Ferrari in 1959.
In 1958, your team Van Wall won the first Constructors' Cup. How did you find Tony Vanderwel as team owner? He was quite a character.
Yes, he was. I mean, he was. I always got on very, very well with Tony Vanderwel, and he was a dictator, which you had to be a successful team. You know, like Ferrari with Ferrari, Enzo Ferrari with Ferrari, and Tony Vanderwel with Van Wall. And I got on very well with Tony. I think we understood each other, and I think he had quite a lot of empathy for the fact that I, you know, tended to get what was left over after Sterling had picked his engine and his chassis. But as I say, I'm not complaining. That was the deal.
Another great character of British motor racing, Colin Chapman, worked for him. When he started his team, was there any opportunity or desire or invitation from Colin to join his team?
Yes, I was invited twice in 1960 and 61, I think. Anyway, 2 years. It might have been 59 and 60. But I very politely turned him down because his cars were very fast and he was a brilliant designer, but unfortunately they had too many mechanical failures for my liking, and it was motor racing was quite dangerous enough at that time without having at the back of your mind that something might fail on the car. So very, very politely I said no, thank you.
The star driver was Jim Clark. Did you get to know him personally a little bit?
Not really, no. It was a little bit after me. I mean, we overlapped in 61, but I was driving a joke of a BRM again, you know, fancy driving twice for BRM. But I didn't see much of him, no. We were technically in the same races in 61, but he was in a competitive car and I was in an interim BRM with a second-hand Convery Climax engine because they hadn't yet produced their own car. The BRM should have been available. The new BRM with the V8 engine should have been available at Monaco in 61. It actually appeared in practice only in Monza. So it was a great disappointment to me because the car, in fact, won the championship the following year. So I chose the right car, but I was 12 months too early.
Okay, in 1958, you won three classic Grand Prix in terms of tracks, Monza, Spa, and Nürburgring. Which track gave you the most satisfaction? Which victory, I'm sorry.
Well, I think I would, you know, put Spa and Nürburgring on a similar level because they were very different circuits, but both, you know, real driver circuits, real challenges. But you can't really, you know, compare one with the other. And but I think the greatest satisfaction I got was from winning the German Grand Prix because it was a very competitive race, and I had to pull back about, you know, 35 seconds on Hawthorne and Mike Hawthorne and Peter Collins, having had a poor start in the race because the car was handling very badly with full petrol tanks. But as the tanks emptied, you know, the car started to handle much better. So to win a race at the Nürburgring was, you know, always a great thing, and to have the great battle with Peter and Mike, I think that gave me more satisfaction winning the German Grand Prix in 58 than Spa. But I got, you know, Spa in some ways, I got more of a thrill driving at Spa than at Nürburgring. But as I say, they're both tremendous driver circuits, but so different, you can't really say one's better than the other. And also it depends which car you're driving at the time as to which, you know, circuit you get the most pleasure from. But Spa gave me probably the greatest pleasure, but the German Grand Prix gave me more pleasure than the Belgian Grand Prix because it was a tremendous battle with Mike and Peter.
Peter Collins was killed in this race while trying to catch you. And he was your teammate in a race before. How do you remember him as a person and a driver? Competitor?
Yes, well, he was very nice, a very good-looking young chap, and of course chased after by the girls, and I always got on very well with Peter, and he was a very, very good driver. And of course, what happened to him took away the pleasure of the race, but when I won the race, I didn't know that it was other than, you know, just another accident, which of course we had only too frequently in the 50s. And so I was not aware how serious it was until some hours after the race.
In the final race, Morocco, your teammate Stuart Lewis Evans was killed, and his manager was Bernie Ecclestone then. And you had a chance to win the championship. How disappointing was it that you were not able to win the championship, Drivers' Championship?
In 58? I had a chance for the championship, yes, but of course, primarily we were trying to help Stirling to win the championship. Well, first of all, our prime objective, which we achieved, was to win the World Manufacturers' Championship. And then the second objective of the team was really to try and get Stirling to win the World Drivers' Championship. But, I mean, given the situation with the cars, you know, and my being number two, my real opportunity to win the championship was in 59, when I, you know, had a car as good and no better than you know, the other drivers in the team. So I finished third, I think it was, in 58. But yes, I wasn't many points behind. But I, as I say, the prime objective there was to beat Mike and to win the manufacturers' championship, which say we did.
Do you think Van Wall would have stayed in Grand Prix racing if Stuart Lewis Evans had not been killed?
Would they have continued, Van Wall, had Stuart Lewis Evans not been killed? We shall never know, but my guess is no, because, of course, it was we'd moved into the rear-engined era, and the front-engine cars were all, you know, were really having great difficulties dealing with the rear-engine cars in 58. And I think most people could see that 59 was going to be difficult for Van Wall to repeat its success against the Coopers and Lotuses. So I think Tony Van der Waal was probably sensible enough to realise that. And of course, it's great to quit when you're ahead. If you win the World Manufacturers' Championship and you think it's going to be very difficult to repeat that, it seems to me psychologically it's a sensible thing to quit.
You mentioned the 1959 season. You were a Ferrari driver. Did you experience the world-famous Ferrari politics at Ferrari?
No, I never had any problem with Enzo Ferrari. I really didn't. And we had a Anglo-American team anyway, because Behra fell out with Ferrari. He was a Frenchman, of course. And he left the team at Reims, the French Grand Prix. And so that left Phil Hill, Dan Gurney, Cliff Allison, myself, and we got on like a house on fire. Very competitive, but on, you know, straightforward manner. You know, great camaraderie, and very competitive, but no nonsense.
You covered my next two questions. Jean Behra, you know, apparently reports say he punched Romolo Tavoni at Reims, the race he won, and Phil Hill was second in that race.
Yes.
He recently passed away. Can you share some thoughts on these two gentlemen, your association and friendship with them, please?
Well, no, not really. I didn't speak French. I spoke Italian, and Behra didn't seem to. He spoke Italian. I wasn't aware that he did, and it must have been fairly basic. So apart from saying hello, hi, bonjour, and so on, I didn't really have much to do with Jean Behra. And of course, Phil Hill was a super chap, and you know, a very good driver, and very simpatico, as we say, as the Italians say. We kept in touch. I used to see them every year, Phil Hill and Dan Gurney, because we have a daughter in California, and we go over every year about Christmas time normally, not this year. And whenever we went over there, we would always have a dinner with Dan and Phil. So we very much kept in touch, and, you know, he was a very warm person, and a great credit as to how he dealt with his illness, really. Absolutely an example to everybody. Top class chap.
two more questions, please. In 1959 Sebring final race, again, you came very close to winning the championship, and you had an incident with your teammate, Fawn Tripps. Can you talk us a little bit about that, and was that a big disappointment winning out on the championship again?
Yes, it was, but in actual fact, I lost the championship earlier in the season in as much as Ferrari didn't go to the British Grand Prix at Aintree because of a strike at the factory, and we'd been first and second in the Aintree 200 about 4 weeks or 5 weeks beforehand, so there should have been some points there because I finished 4 points short of Jack Brabham at the end of the year, who won the championship. And then the Spa, the Belgian Grand Prix, was cancelled, which would have been a Ferrari circuit as opposed to the slow to medium speed circuits, which were more suited to the Lotus and Coopers. So Spa would have been a good chance for the Ferrari to win. I'd won every time I'd been to Spa, which is no guarantee, but we should have been in with a good chance there. And then at the Italian Grand Prix, I was a tenth of a second behind Sterling, who was on pole, and they challenged the clutch of the car overnight and either didn't bed it in or fit it properly, and I did about 100 metres, and Phil Hill finished second in that race, so again one would reasonable to assume that we should have some points there. So then we came to Sebring when we still had a chance of winning the championship, as did Sterling Moss and Jack Brabham. And I should have been on the front row with them, but Harry Schell was credited with a time he never did because he missed out one of the corners, and he pushed me off my front row position across the grid to the second lap, second line, and which put me in front of Van Tripps. And he was busy trying to convince Ferrari that he should be a regular Formula One driver. And I think that was his first drive in a Formula One Ferrari. I may be wrong, but he was intent on trying to say, look, I should be in the team. And, of course, what better way of convincing the Ferrari that he should be in the team would be to follow the team leader, as I was then, having on the basis of my results. And so he was intent on following the team leader, which he did, to the point where he shunted me up the rear on the first lap. I came into the pits to check the car out to make sure that that there was nothing, no serious damage to it, and I lost virtually a lap in coming into the pits, and I needed to finish first in that race, and in fact I finished third, and finished second in the championship with just 4 points behind Jack Brabham, and we both won the same number of Grand Prix, and is the one that got away. But every racing driver's got their hard luck story, but that's a longer one than average, I think.
A final question. Watkins Glen, 1961, first Grand Prix win for Team Lotus and final race for Tony Brooks, and with a podium finish. What were the main reasons for retiring from motor racing?
Well, there isn't a simple answer to this one, it's not a sort of, it was this. It was a combination of things. I mean, first of all, I didn't have to continue with motor racing for as a career because I had a perfectly good dental degree. The second thing was that I realised that one had to have a degree of luck to win the World Championship, which Sterling had proven pretty well. But what convinced me about the need for luck and the fact you could go on for a long time without winning the championship was in 58, Sterling and I won three Grand Prix each for Van Wall. He won a fourth because he went to the Argentine with Rob Walker's Cooper. So he had four Grand Prix, I had three Grand Prix, and the world champion had one. I thought, well, funny. And then in 59, I've already explained, in 59, it could have happened, and it didn't happen. So I realised that you needed a bit of luck on your side to win the Drivers' Championship. And the most important thing, which I should have put first, of course, is that I had married Pina and was starting a family. And as I said, I didn't have to motor race to earn a living. So whereas most of the other racing drivers didn't have a good way of earning a living apart from motor racing. And so that wasn't a valid excuse for me continuing. The next reason was that I looked at my career and said, well, it's not bad because I'd won 7 Grand Prix, 6 of them World Championship Grand Prix. In fact, I won 50% of the Grand Prix. I finished between 55 and 59 those 5 years. And so, you know, it wasn't a bad record. And a good gambler quits when he's ahead. And the other factor was that they'd gone to the Formula One, had become 1.5 litres in 1961. And I mean, really, you know, to be able to get satisfaction out of driving and to show whether in fact you're better than the guy next door, you really need a car that has more power than the chassis can handle. And those cars were, you know, equivalent about 100cc go-kart. They were absolutely pathetic. So it's an amalgam of those things that made me think, and I'll say, essentially, a good gambler quits when he's ahead.
Finally, would you please give a message to our listeners?
Well, thank you very much for taking the trouble to listen to a very brief summary of my career. I hope to fill out a little bit more with my own personal biography in due course. I say my personal biography because most of them are written by others, but I've been convinced against my better judgment to in fact write the whole thing myself, because I've always written my own articles. So if you want to hear more about my career, there might be something you might be interested in the future.
We are very much, and I read about this, that you have very extensive notes, like Stirling Moss, maybe more. When is the book coming out, please?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got to produce it, and, you know, I've got a lot of things that take me away from, you know, from beating out the keys on my laptop. So I don't want to be committed to a date. You know, I will produce it as soon as I can, and hopefully before I'm called to some other place. So I'm totally refused to put a deadline on it, but I am beavering away, and I shall produce it in good time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Hi, I'm Pato O'Ward, and you are listening to F1 Weekly.
Okay, folks, I'm here at Daytona with Zach Brown. Zach, good to see you again. How are you today?
Yeah, very good. Excited for the race.
Great enthusiasm and excitement at McLaren for the 2018 season. What are the realistic expectations?
We want to get to the front of the field. You know, we've got built a really good race car. We've got the two drivers that we wanted. We've got a great team. We think we've got a good power unit. So our desire is to get on the podium. Not sure which step yet, but we haven't been on the podium in a long time. So I think that's the that's got to be the target for the year.
How long is the agreement to use Renault power, and do you think it is possible for McLaren to win the championship with a customer engine deal?
Yeah, I do think we can win with a customer engine, because I think Renault in particular gives the same equipment to all their customers. Red Bull obviously won 4 championships with the power unit, so I think we're comfortable there. And then our agreement goes up until the end of this current agreement within Formula One. So when the rules start over again in 2021, I don't believe anybody really has a contract beyond that at this point.
Okay. Your association with McLaren started before joining the team. Did Mansoor Oje play a major part in you joining the team?
Absolutely. I wouldn't have joined the team without Mansoor Oje and Sheikh Mohammed. And in addition to it being a great team, you know, it's important that you work for people that you've got a tremendous amount of respect for, and I couldn't be happier to work for Mansoor and Sheikh Mohammed.
Last time we met at Laguna Seca, you told us how you started in racing with TWA sponsorship. What major deals are you planning to land this season? We need a scoop, please.
Well, we announced our first new partner, CNBC, last week. We'll be making another announcement next week. And we'll be making another announcement the following week. So, and then hopefully a few more. So we've got some great partners lined up. Great livery for this upcoming year. So I think it's going to be quite exciting.
I heard you don't want the team to be known as a AT&T McLaren or a Marlboro McLaren. You're really focused on the brand. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think ultimately in Formula One, unlike, say, NASCAR, where the driver gets out of the car and thanks his, you know, SAP Ford, Formula One's not really an environment like that. So if you look at the title sponsors that are in the sport, I think you definitely want to have title-level branding on the car, but I think you want to keep your name pure, as our opinion. We're McLaren, and you know, so everything's open for discussion if someone's really set on it, but I don't think the title of the team adds a tremendous amount of value. I think the value comes from the exposure on the car, and then you know, we have a brand we want to continue to build, and if it changes every 5 years, it makes it hard to be consistent in your branding. So that's why we've gone down that path.
Okay. Do you expect Señor Alonso to stay in Formula One beyond 2018 and with McLaren?
I think if Fernando stays in Formula One beyond 2018, it will be with McLaren. But ultimately, we've agreed to see how the season goes and then have a conversation about the future. What's for sure is that you know, we'd like Fernando to finish his racing career, not just his Formula One career, at McLaren. So I still think we're early in our relationship with Fernando.
You have another great talent in Lando Norris. What did your team offer him that other teams could not, especially when this was done during the difficult time with Honda?
I think someone like Lando sees the history of McLaren with the second most successful team in the history of the sport. It's a great team. We all knew, while we're not perfect, where our issues have come from. We've now hopefully solved those, so we can expect to get back to the front. And you know, I think I want to race. There's no team I would have rather race for than McLaren. I think it's either probably McLaren or Ferrari on most drivers' lists. So I'm not surprised he made the decision.
Stoffel Vandoorne has won anything and everything so far, all the other championships. Comfortable with him as one of your long-term drivers?
Yep, we have him under long-term contract. So, you know, we do like to make sure we've got two best drivers in the world in our car at any one time. He really came to have some success the second half of the year. The first half was a bit of a struggle, but you know, we didn't give him a very good and reliable and fast race car. So yeah, we're very pleased with him.
Your man Alonso made some very interesting comments during the past two seasons, like karma at Monza and GP2 engine of all the places at Suzuka. Has the team made any requests to be a little bit careful on team radio, especially at Paul Ricard this year?
Why Paul Ricard? Oh, be able to be in Renault. no. You know, Fernando, you know, like all these drivers, have a range of emotions when they're in the race car, and if they're not happy, they make comments, but we're not going to try and control our drivers. It's important that you let them be as they are, and so no.
Incredible performance he had at Indy last year. Did that surprise you?
He didn't surprise me. How well everyone came together was a surprise, because it was a tall order in a very short period of time with a lot of moving parts, and we didn't have a single issue. So the collaboration with IndyCar, the partnership with Michael Andretti went perfect, and Fernando really had, up until lap 179, it was the perfect month of May.
You have been very successful in big-name sponsorships. Why have you not seen big American global giants like Pepsi and Coke, where they can also advertise other famous brands like Fanta and Mountain Dew on the car in Formula One?
Well, hopefully that'll change. You know, Formula One is not where it needs to be in North America, but I think that's going to hopefully change and grow. And then all these companies have different audiences, so you get into the Cokes, and they tend to choose the you know, ones I think in FIFA and the others in Olympics, and then you have Formula One. Those are your really big three global platforms, and I would say to some Formula One wasn't a very user-friendly environment, but that's now changing.
Your team, United Autosports, is racing here at Daytona. What is the long-term plan for this team, and can we see Nando be part of Le Mans effort down the road as part of this team?
Well, if Fernando were to do Le Mans, I'm sure he'd want to do it in LMP1. So until we're in LMP1, I don't think Fernando would race at Le Mans with United Autosports because of the class that we're in. We're obviously in Daytona, it's the lead class. United's grown to be much bigger than I thought it would ever be. We're having great success winning races, winning championships. So right now we're focused on 18, depending on what the rules look like for P1 in the future, that would maybe be something that we could consider, as long as it's economically viable.
Okay. There's also talk of McLaren coming back into IndyCar full time. Are there any plans in the next couple of years for that?
We're looking at it. IndyCar is something that we've got great history in. We've won it 3 times, twice as a team. North America is an important marketplace for us. So it's something we're definitely looking at. I think it fits the brand well. We like it. Fernando wants to go back and try and win the 500, and I'd like to see us in